Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 169. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're doing two Godfrey Cambridge movies from 1970. The first one's very political, and it is Watermelon Man, directed by Melvin Van Peebles. And then we go on to something a little funner, which is Ossie Davis's Cotton Comes to Harlem, also starring Raymond St. Jakes and Calvin Lockhart. So sit back, we'll get the contact details done and start the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of classic movie appreciation. The rules are pretty simple. The movie has to be at least 20 years old and I have to like it. Now, you can leave feedback via MP3 or email to cultguru@gmail.com. That's K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, which would be appreciated. You can also leave a review on iTunes, but please send me an email when you do so I can check it out. You can also go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and like that page if you want updates. This podcast may contain naughty words and adult concepts, so if you don't want to do a lot of explaining to small children, listen to it with your headphones on. Hey, how's everybody going? We are pretty okay here. It's still a bit cold, but spring will come soon and all will be well, and my mood will be much more sanguine. I'm gonna do a rant. I decided I am now going to do a brief rant before I talk about the movies I've been watching. There was a big kerfuffle in the universe. There was a ripple through the force when this week they released all of the toys for the new Star Wars movie, and everybody who wet themselves watching the first Star Wars when they were a child went squee and went out and spent a lot of money on toys. And that gave rise to, of course, the discussion that Star Wars, after the first movie, has become basically a franchise for toys rather than for movies. And there's a strong argument for that, and I support that argument to a certain extent. I don't know what the new movie's going to be like. I've got no idea. People keep leaking images from it, and they're kind of following the Marvel model to a certain extent, given that the same parent company now owns both franchises. And so they're kind of going with that media strategy. But I know there are a couple of good actors in it. I like Oscar Isaac a lot as an actor. John Boyega has a lot of chops as well. So we'll see how we go. But one or two things will happen. One, the movie will disappoint the fuck out of everybody. Or two, their hype will prevail and everybody will go, oh yeah, this is a wonderful thing. And yeah, the goodies versus baddies, unnuanced kind of approach is what exactly we want to see. But for me, I'm not even sure I'm going to go see it. I may well do, but I'm not optimistic about it. Let's call it that. I may well review it for the Martian Drive-In podcast, should I go to see it. But I'm not at all in love with the Star Wars franchise. I find the universe incredibly unnuanced. It doesn't have the emotional complexity of other franchises, say the James Bond franchise, or even the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it's, it just pisses me off, to be honest. And the fact that they do an enormous release of the toys first is a pretty good indication of things, and a pretty good indication that that's where they're going to make the majority of their money. Yeah, whether the movie will be successful, there's no doubt about it. It'll make a shit ton of money, the same way that the last three Star Wars movies made a shit ton of money. But it's all about the merch, and I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing for cinema. But yeah, let me know what you think. You can argue with me if you like. I know it's more a Martian Driving kind of rant than it is a Paleo Cinema rant, but that's how I feel. And I'm not buying any of their toys, and I think that little round robot is an incredibly dumb design. But on to more interesting things, at least for me. What have I been watching since last time I did a podcast? I did see Mission to Mars, the Brian De Palma movie from 2000. I watched that again. And again, it's a two-thirds of a good movie. You got all the good stuff right till they get down to the surface of the planet and they find Don Cheadle there playing Ben Gunn from Treasure Island, and basically iterate the whole plot of the new movie, The Martian, pretty much, with Don Cheadle instead of Matt Damon. But then when they start getting into the gosh wow metaphysical aliens kind of thing, it kind of loses me a lot. But I liked right up to then. I think they've got some interesting character development in it. They get the science almost right up to that point, and they do a pretty good job of things. So that's a kind of missed opportunity. I may do it on Martian Drive-In, I may not, but one way or the other, watch 70% of the movie and just forget the last 25%. 30%, sorry, 30%. The other thing I watched was a movie by The Asylum, that production house that does incredibly cheap movies. I only did it because in our horror block, which is a subscription service where you get a T-shirt and a bunch of toys and stuff every month, we got a copy of this movie on Blu-ray as part of the horror block. And it's Rise of the Zombies, starring Danny Trejo. Now, Danny Trejo's not in it for most of the movie, but he's the big-name guy, so they've got him on the cover. It's a kind of low-budget zombie apocalypse movie. It does have a bunch of other people in it. Mariel Hemingway's in it. LeVar Burton's in it. A group of other people are in it. But it's pretty piss poor and ordinary. I know The Asylum does these things on a budget and churns them out and makes money from them, but it's not a very good one. And there seems to be times when the movie just drags on and on and on, even though it doesn't have a long running time. So I don't recommend that at all. I do recommend Final Score, though. Final Score is the movie that was crowdfunded for a DVD release, and it does have a commentary track attached to it by the guys from The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. Big Willie and the Samurai did the commentary track for it, which is very cool, and I was glad to support it. And I finally got my copy of it in the mail this week. And yeah, it's a kind of Death Wish movie. With instead of Charles Bronson, what you have is Christopher Mitchum, the son of Robert Mitchum. And it's all set in Jakarta in Indonesia. So it's an Indonesian horror action film, not a horror film. I'm still thinking of Rise of the Zombies. It's an Indonesian action film. Got some incredible stunt work, which probably crippled about 25 people. Lots of explosions, lots of nastiness, a very ugly rape scene. And, yeah, it's very 1980s kind of action cinema, and I can understand why the gents love it. I maybe love it a little less than they do, but I'm glad that they did it. I'm glad that they got it at a release. And if you're interested in kind of VHS era action flicks, Final Score is definitely one to go with. So congratulations to the guys for getting that out. And I may rewatch it when I'm a little less tired, just to kind of groove on the action stuff a little bit more. But then we get to something from 1964, which is Bedtime Story, which they remade as Dirty Rotten Scoundrels with Steve Martin and Michael Caine. But the original had David Niven and Marlon Brando in it. And it was from 1964. It had also Shirley Jones playing the love interest in it. But it's the same kind of thing. Two con men who basically live by conning women meet up in the south of France and kind of buddy up for a time. When they start getting involved with conning a lady played by Shirley Jones out of the money that they think she has. Now, this is a fun movie. It works really well. I think it should get a Blu-ray release and a DVD release. I don't know that it has yet because I haven't seen it around. The copy I've seen is a VHS rip. But it's real fun for a couple of reasons, one of which is that Marlon Brando is very, very funny in the film. He does comedy really well. And in fact, Brando himself has said that this is one of the movies that he most enjoyed making. It's silly. It's got a whole bunch of character actors in the background. It's got it's one of those movies that's a kind of black comedy because these guys are living from conning women, essentially. But I think this is probably and arguably the funniest thing that Brando ever did. And yes, we accept that Brando was a great actor and he did dramatic roles incredibly well. But he was underrated as a comic actor. And in this one, he gets to shine. And there are roles that I hate Brando in. And I hate the fact that he kind of walked through them. But this one, it's light. It's a souffle, but it's a lot of fun to watch. The only other thing I watched was a 1970s campus drama called Getting Straight, starring Candace Bergman and Elliot Gould. Now, it's about kind of unrest in the campus of a university in Oregon in the 1970s. So it's got all the usual campus radicals. It's got all the usual tight-assed authority figures. And in the middle of it, there's a character called Harry, played by Elliot Gould, who's a mature-age student who's gone back to university and wants to become a teacher. He went to Vietnam and then came back again. And he's trying to get through the last week of his degree while there's unrest in the campus, which he's involved because he's an old student radical from as far back as the early 1960s and late 1950s. And he's used as a resource by the younger campus radicals. They've also got some really nice character actors in there. Jeff Corey's in there. There's a role by a very young Harrison Ford in this one. All of the tropes of 1970 counterculture cliche, not the actual fact of them, but cliche there. And there's also some sexual politics in there, particularly with Harry's relationship with the character played by Candace Bergman and the way he treats her and the way she treats him and the way they talk things around and their wants and needs and all kinds of stuff like that. So it's quite interesting, and it's almost a historic movie in the sense that it's about a certain time in history, which now is 45 years ago, and what was important to people then and how Hollywood saw the civil rights movement, particularly as far as students were concerned, and how much of education should the student body have an influence on and how much is basically necessary. There's some side plots in there about conscription and the Vietnam War and all of those other issues. There's a black radical character in there played by Max Julian from the movie The Mac, who has a nuanced character as well. I mean, there's some nice writing in here, but it doesn't really hold together as a whole, but it's worth seeing for that kind of historical context and just to see how things were seen at the time. And it does end on a very kind of anarchic yet romantic note, which is kind of a little bit odd. But Getting Straight's a movie that's worth checking out if you're interested in that period of American cinema history. It doesn't quite know whether it's a comedy or a serious drama. It has aspects of both, and it's got some snappy dialogue as well. So that's about it for the stuff I have been watching. So I'm going to take a break. When we get back, we're going to be talking about the first of the two movies that I've got, which Godfrey Cambridge, a now forgotten actor and comedian, starred in 1970. And this one is directed by Melvin Van Peebles, also stars Estelle Parsons. And it is called Watermelon Man. Watermelon Man is a 1970 American comedy drama film directed by Melvin Van Peebles. It was written by Herman Raucher and tells the story of an extremely bigoted 1960s-era white insurance salesman named Jeff Gerber who wakes up one morning to find that he's become black. That's pretty much the premise of the movie. It was a studio film, and it was the first studio film that Melvin Van Peebles ever did. In fact, it was the only studio film that Van Peebles ever did. He did one feature film before this one, which he made in France, and it's called The Story of a Three-Day Pass. It was about a black soldier having a liaison with a white girl in France. He made it for about $100,000, and a lot of it was in French. He also did an episode of the 1970 iteration of The Bill Cosby Show. I'll leave aside all of the Bill Cosby baggage there. But apparently a lot of people were a bit concerned with Melvin Van Peebles doing episodic American comedy TV because he said motherfucker and things like that a lot. And people were scared for their families to come onto the set because at that time it was considered not the thing to do to have somebody say motherfucker in a place where women or children could hear it. But so the movie was set up by the studio, and the studio decided that what they wanted to do was have a white actor play the role of Jeff Gerber, the insurance salesman who becomes black. So they were talking around people like Alan Arkin, for instance, or Jack Lemmon to play the role. And then they get Melvin Van Peebles, who was very much a civil rights activist and quite a left-wing figure. So they get Van Peebles on board to direct the film because they think it adds cachet to get a black director, of course. And so Van Peebles immediately says, you can't have a white actor playing this role. We've got to have a black actor, and we put him in whiteface for the first part of the movie. Otherwise, it's just not going to work. What the fuck are you people thinking? So they chose an actor who was known for both, for several things. And that actor was Godfrey Cambridge. The first thing he was known for was being a comic actor. He'd done stand-up comedy. He'd also done some serious roles too, so he was steering in the direction of some serious acting. And also, in the 1950s and 1960s, he was very much a part of the civil rights movement. He was the first one of the people who was on the first fundraiser for Martin Luther King that was done. And he was very, very big on the civil rights movement and things like that. He had an interesting history too, Godfrey Cambridge. His parents were from British Guyana in South America and came to America. They decided that the school system for black kids in America wasn't good enough. So they sent Godfrey Cambridge to Sydney, Nova Scotia to get his initial education. And then he came back, became very successful as an actor. He did serious stage roles. He did the stand-up stuff at the Hungry Eye and places like that around New York City, and went on to have a good career for a certain period. As an actor, he was in The President's Analyst, for instance, with James Coburn, and I talked about that when I talked about The President's Analyst a lot of podcasts ago. Really an interesting guy. I've seen some footage of him being interviewed by William F. Buckley in the early 1970s. He came across as a very intelligent, literate guy with a straightforward opinion about things, and that was kind of cool. Unfortunately, he died early at the age of 43 of a heart attack when he was making Victory at Entebbe, playing Edie Armin in that, so he didn't get to play the role ultimately. And Edie Armin himself said that he put a curse on Godfrey Cambridge, which is what's killed him. But Cambridge, a really interesting actor, now almost forgotten. People don't talk about Godfrey Cambridge much in the history of American cinema or in the history of blaxploitation. And this movie is arguably a part of blaxploitation cinema. It's one of those movies that the studios were starting to get a feel that having movies starring black people and with a black theme would be box office. And they kind of wanted to tap into the civil rights movement as a cash flow thing and get movies that were of interest to people who had interest in that. So they make this movie. And, yeah, at the start, Godfrey Cambridge makes a very unconvincing white man in everything but his acting. The makeup and the look of Godfrey Cambridge didn't lend itself to thinking he was at all Caucasian at any time. But that's kind of okay because think of all the blackface stuff. Jolson's Story was the biggest biggest box office film of 1946, and that had Larry Parks dressing up in blackface. Song of the South was very successful in 1948, I think it was. And that had Uncle Remus and all that kind of stuff. Gone with the Wind was one of the most successful movies of all time, and it had some very dubious racial stuff in it. So if they have one movie like this one, where for the first third of the movie, a man of colour gets dressed up in whiteface, then I think that's not necessarily an unfair thing. So Godfrey Cambridge plays Jeff Gerber, a white insurance salesman, which is two strikes against him right there. He's got a wife, Althea, played by Estelle Parsons, who's very good in the role she does. She kind of is more interested in civil rights at the start of the film than Jeff is, and spends her evenings watching riots and civil rights stuff on TV in the evenings. And she thinks that because she does that, then she's a liberal and she's in favour of civil rights and all that kind of thing. But she uses it more as entertainment in the evenings on television than she does as any serious political commitment. We all know people like that. So Jeff also, there's a beautiful bit at the front of the film where the rat race, as it was called then, that kind of 9-to-5 grind kind of job, is made manifest literally by Jeff's routine in the morning. He spends some time under a suntan lamp. He does some exercises which wake Althea up in the morning. He then has a thing where what he does is he waits for the bus to go past. The bus is going to take him to work, and he races the bus half the way to work. So he runs and basically chases the bus and tries to get to the last bus stop where he gets on the bus to save some money before the bus gets there. And all the people on the bus are hoping that he fails because he's a bit of an asshole. He thinks he's a nice guy, but he's really an asshole. And so the bus driver, played by Derville Martin, who's black, and all of the white people on the bus basically dislike Jeff because he raises the bus and teases them and always manages to catch the bus. So the rat race, the kind of 9-to-5 grind, is made into a literal race between Jeff and the commuter transport he uses to get to work. His boss is an asshole too. The insurance company staff seem to like him, except for one of the people in there, a buxom blonde woman called Erica, who just doesn't like him. And so Jeff is living his life. He's got his wife out there. He's got a boy and a girl. Son and a daughter, one of whom is played by Erin Moran, who people later knew from Happy Days. And suddenly one night Jeff goes to sleep and wakes up in the morning and finds out that he has turned black. His skin's turned black, his formerly straight hair is no longer straight, and he thinks he's having a nightmare. So he goes back to bed. He's got up in the middle of the night, he goes back to bed and wakes up in the morning, and sure enough, he has become black. Now, Jeff at first thinks that it's a combination of the tanning suntan lamp that he uses, and he has a special suntan lotion, which has, amongst other things, soy sauce in it, and the energy drink he drinks in the morning. But it turns out, as his doctor tells him, that basically he has turned black. Now, this then, in the middle-class world that Jeff lives in, causes him immense amounts of trouble. When he runs for the bus as a black man, the cops arrest him, thinking he stole something. And the insurance company also has some problems about him being a black man, and they decide to use it as an opportunity and to try to get him to get them some black customers. But because he's basically, even though he's a bit of an asshole, he's not a bad guy, he tries to give good insurance advice to the black community, and his sales go down, and ultimately he gets the sack. And then he also has problems at home. His wife has trouble dealing with the fact that she suddenly has a black husband. He's been getting calls on the phone, anonymous phone calls, and this is, of course, before it was easy to track these things, saying, you know, move out, N-word, and all that kind of thing. And he comes home one night, and a bunch of his neighbours are in his lounge room with his wife and decide they're going to buy him out so that the real estate values in the neighbourhood don't go down if it's found out that a black man is living in the neighbourhood. So all of those kind of issues, which are totally stupid and totally pointless and totally wrong, come to play and suddenly impinge on Jeff Gerber. His wife Althea sends their children away to Cincinnati to stay with relatives and ultimately moves out. Jeff, of course, sells the house at a wildly inflated price to his neighbors. He basically takes them for every cent he can get, and that pisses off Althea because she says, you're taking advantage of these people because they're willing to pay you out because you're black, not really realizing the hypocrisy in her own rhetoric there. He has an affair with Erica, the blonde bombshell at the office, basically because Erica has a thing for black men. And he kind of, after his liaison, there's a really great scene, and the liaison actually shows one of the unfortunate things about the actress Kay Kimberly, who plays Erica. In 1970, breast augmentation surgery was not as advanced as it is now, and she has some quite unusual looking breast augmentation surgery, and there is a topless scene with her. But leaving that aside, Jeff has a liaison with her, and during the post-coital discussion, he accused her of being racist because she would only be attracted to him when he became a black man. And she eventually shows her racism in various loudly vocal ways, and Jeff kind of walks away a little bit more knowledgeable about his condition and about the way black men are perceived in society. And ultimately, he starts his own insurance company, and the film does have a nice twist at the end, which is very much unlike a lot of other studio films of the time. Now, Columbia Pictures, who made the film, originally had the script which resulted in Jeff waking up one morning and he's turned white again, which is a cop-out of a script ending, if you ask me, and Melvin Van Peebles agreed. So I'm going to play about a couple of minutes of Melvin Van Peebles many years later talking about his experience of making Watermelon Man as a black director in 1970 working with the studio system.
Watermelon Man, people getting 45 days, 90 days to shoot a film, blah, 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 blah. And they gave me 23 days to shoot the film, setting me up. So I shot it in 21.
This was Columbia Pictures?
Mm-hmm.
And you felt that they were setting you up to fail?
What?
You felt that...
But you, were setting every, you up. But the time it takes to make a film is, I mean, the normal shooting time was much longer. So if you make it, then they would have given me more time. But he said, well, he went 10 days over, 15 days over. Not that he had 25 less days than everybody else got in the first place. Huh? So I didn't say nothing. I said,
What did you think of the script itself? What did you think of Watermelon Man?
Well, it was called The Night the Sun Came Out on Sleepy Hollow Lane. And I remember the guy, the writer, came to me afterwards, all of them sending notes saying I had betrayed his... It didn't end like that. You see, the film ended with a guy, you know, one morning wakes up, one evening, one night, he goes to the job and he's black. And then all these things happen to him. And then the original script, he goes to take another crap or whatever he's doing, and he's white again. That's the end of the movie. I said, that ain't the way it's gone. Well, no, Mel, so we all had a talk. And we decided we'd shoot it both ways. And that's what we did. Except I only shot it my way.
What did you say to them when they said, well, where's ours?
Oh, Lord of mercy, I done forgot. What'd you expect me to say? I didn't say, well, you racist dogs. Do you think I'm going to fall for that?
So, Melvin Van Peebles makes the movie. The movie's successful. It made $1.1 million in the box office, which is a lot more than it cost to make, particularly given that it only took 21 days to shoot, which is pretty amazing to make a feature film, even one with the budget this one has, in that period of time. But so Columbia Pictures offered Melvin Van Peebles a three-picture deal after this. He'd made the money. He'd worked under the pressure that they'd applied to him and made a successful movie. It was fairly well regarded in the press, particularly the alternative press at the time. So they offer him a three-picture deal. Melvin Van Peebles tells him to shove it. He then goes and decides to make an independent film, which was Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, one of the seminal blaxploitation movies, and up until that time, the most successful independent movie in world history. So he made that and went on his own path and kind of helped with both Watermelon Man and with Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song to kickstart the blaxploitation genre, which ended up being a phenomenon over about maybe a little less than a decade, but nonetheless was influential in changing cinema and also in getting black actors, technicians, writers and directors gigs so they could learn the business and kind of expanded the range of human beings who were involved in the movie-making process in America. So, Watermelon Man, I like it. I'll let you know my analysis of it. Yeah, I can forgive the whiteface stuff at the start where... because of the history of blackface. I think jamming it in people's face right at the start is a good thing. I like the fact that Godfrey Cambridge, when he's both, his character of Jeff, both when he's white, and for a large portion of when he's black, is an asshole in a lot of ways. I mean, it'd be different if he was a nice guy kind of thing. The usual thing you do in a comedy is have a nice white guy suddenly turn black and have him be kind of, shocked and horrified and beleaguered by the experiences he suddenly had as a black man, which may have been the way they would have played it had they had a white actor playing that. But it would have been emotionally and sociologically dishonest to do it that way. And so having Godfrey Cambridge playing the role and playing Jeff as a bit of an asshole who does eventually have an epiphany about the nature of his position as an unexpected man of colour in American society, and I'm not just kind of, saying American society is racist. Fuck knows that Australian society is as well to a large extent, and under the current regime increasingly so. So I'm not just trying to kind of America bash on this one. But, yeah, it does go where it needs to go to get a satisfying story there, and Jeff's arc as a character is a good one, and it's an important one, and it kind of conveyed to white audiences, particularly me, was some of what it was like to be a black man at that time. Of course, what you can't really live in another person's skin, but you can have somebody wearing that skin tell you what it's like and show you what it's like, and it's a bonus for you, and it's a kindness to you to do it in an entertainment form and to do it as part of a movie. Now, I like Godfrey Cambridge in this film because he does give you that asshole. He plays the asshole really well in this. Godfrey Cambridge was an actor also who had a lot of trouble with his weight at various times. He was a lot heavier, for instance, in The President's Analyst in 1967 than he was in either Watermelon Man or in Cotton Comes to Harlem. And he had those issues as well as the issues of being a black man in America. Though he was an incredibly successful stand-up comedian, his career did falter somewhat in the later 1970s, and he almost retired at one stage, but he came back to make Victory at Entebbe and unfortunately died during the filming of that. But I liked him. He was an intelligent man. He was very much a part of the civil rights movement at a time when other people were keeping their head down. He was funny. He was a good comedian and a talented serious actor as well, and you get to see both those aspects of him in this film and also in Cotton Comes to Harlem. And Watermelon Man is, in a sense, of its time. It was a movie that could only be made around 1970, where people were questioning the nature of society a lot more openly, and people were punching upward in society when they were making their art. And this film definitely does that. It's worth revisiting, and there are bits of it that are kind of crude and roughly done, and there's some sexism in it, and the relationship between Jeff and Althea isn't as enlightened as it would be were it a post-millennial 21st century kind of relationship. But I like the film. I like the fact that Dan Peebles beat the studio system at their own game to an extent to make this film, and then went on to follow his own path and be incredibly successful doing that. He played the trickster on this one, and it really worked in his favour. So Watermelon Man, I'm really going to have to pick up a DVD of this one. The copy I've got is a little bit subterranean, but it's a good quality print. But I think, as I often do with movies that I talk about in Paleo Cinema Podcast, it's a movie worth having a permanent medium of and worth paying the owners of it to have. The satire and the comedy are a little bit broad at times, but there's a depth to them as well, and that's nice. I've seen broad comedies that are all surface, and there are any number of them out there now as much as in 1970, but occasionally you get comedies that are broadly satirical, and you can't get more overtly satirical than a white man turning black and living in a black man's life. But this one definitely does it, and because of the chosen subject matter, it does have that depth to it. So anyway, I'm going to leave you now with a song from Watermelon Man called Love That's America, which Van Peebles himself performed. And the song had a bit of a revival in 2011 because videos set to the song featured footage from the Occupy Wall Street protests in 2011, and they were uploaded to YouTube and became viral for a time, which goes to show, of course, that the theme of the movie and of the song that starts the movie is still timely. With Ferguson and all the other issues going on in America at the moment, a lot of the themes of this movie and this particular song, Love That's America, are still unfortunately relevant.
Watermelon Man, people getting 45 days, 90 days to shoot a film, blah, 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 blah. And they gave me 23 days to shoot the film, setting me up. So I shot it in 21.
This was Columbia Pictures?
Mm-hmm.
And you felt that they were setting you up to fail?
What?
You felt that
Columbia was setting you up. But the time it takes to make a film is, I mean, the normal shooting time was much longer. So if you make it, then they would have given me more time. But he said, well, he went 10 days over, 15 days over. Not that he had 25 less days than everybody else got in the first place. Huh? So I didn't say nothing. I said,
What did you think of the script itself? What did you think of Watermelon Man?
Well, it was called The Night the Sun Came Out on Sleepy Hollow Lane. And I remember the guy, the writer, came to me afterwards, all of them sending notes saying I had betrayed his... It didn't end like that. You see, the film ended with a guy, one morning wakes up, one evening, one night, he goes to the job and he's black. And then all these things happen to him. And then the written script, he goes to take another crap or whatever he's doing, and he's white again. That's the end of the movie. I said, that ain't the way it's gone. Well, no, Mel, so we all had a talk, and we decided we'd shoot it both ways. And that's what we did. Except I only shot it my way.
What did you say to them when they said, well, where's ours?
Oh, Lord of mercy, I done forgot. What did you expect me to say? I didn't say, well, you racist dogs, do you think I'm going to fall for that?
Introducing two cops only a mother could love. Meet Coffin Ed Johnson and Grave Digger Jones, two of New York's finest. Two cops who take charge when an $87,000 bale of cotton comes to Harlem.
Tell me something, will you? What's the bale of cotton doing in Harlem?
A bale of cotton?
Bale of cotton.
No, what would a bale of cotton be doing in Harlem?
Down south, cotton was king.
Cotton comes to Harlem. It's Cops and Robbers, with a shade of difference.
See any cotton around here lately?
A bale of cotton, sure.
Where is it now?
Did you turn Japanese?
Huh? Wait, come on, you know the position. Come on.
Damn it.
Another fine mess you got us into.
I got us into. Shut up and shoot.
Godfrey Cambridge is Grave Digger Jones. Raymond St. Jock is Coffin Ed Johnson. Calvin Lockhart.
Well, if it ain't King Kong and Frankenstein.
Hey, what kind of talk is that, soul brother? Don't you know that black is beautiful?
They put a personal touch on everything they handle.
You have to play with that thing.
I'm insecure, Captain.
They're big. They're cool. They're beautiful.
Where is that bale of cotton?
There ain't no such thing as a bale of cotton in Harlem.
Is that black enough for you?
I finally found that bale of cotton.
One thing's for sure. It ain't drugstore cotton.
This is genuine Mississippi cotton.
Don't you know if cotton come to Harlem? Come on, let's boot cotton's blood.
Get me a stick and I'm gonna kick cotton in the butt.
Coffin Ed Johnson and Grave Digger Jones, two cops only a mother could love.
Cotton Comes to Harlem is a 1970 action film co-written and directed by Ossie Davis. The actor Ossie Davis, it was his first directorial effort. It stars Godfrey Cambridge, Raymond St. Jakes, Red Fox, Calvin Lockhart, Judy Pace, and a number of other fine actors. Now, I came at this movie kind of through the back door, no anal allusions intended, by reading the books first, the Chester Himes Coffinhead and Gravedigger novels. I read because they were out in a cheap paperback edition at the time, and being a voracious reader then as now, I absorbed them and liked them. The books are really good. I've actually found some Kindle versions of them, and I'm looking forward to rereading them because I haven't for a very long time. The writing is crisp and sharp. The humour is very much as in the movie, urban black humour, but it does travel quite well. And the plots are kind of really cool. Chester Himes is one of the great lesser-known crime writers of the 20th century, really fine crime writer. And I highly recommend you find any of his crime novels. You'll dive in and find them very accessible, really fun to read, and a great way of spending some time. Now, I do actually have the Daybill movie poster of Cotton Comes to Harlem. As you know, I do collect Daybill movie posters, the Australian movie posters that are in the 30-inch long, 13-inch wide format. And it's a groovy poster. If you just type in Cotton Comes to Harlem into Google, you'll see what the movie poster was like. Beautiful, nice piece of illustration there. And I'm very happy to have the poster of the movie. But so I came at it from the back door. Now, the original version I saw in cinemas in the early 1970s is an Australian version which was cut. I actually looked up the censorship on Cotton Comes to Harlem in 1970. They cut out 45 seconds of the movie, and the reason given, now I don't have any more detail than this, the reason given by the censors at the time was violence and indecency. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, those were two things I looked for in a movie. And as far as I can tell, reflecting on the most recent viewing of the film and the viewing of the film I did at the time, most of the bits that were cut out were bits of Judy Pace playing one of the characters who has a prolonged nude scene and maybe a little bit of violence that I haven't remembered. But Judy Pace this is an interesting role for her, but I'll get back to that. So basically the story is Reverend Dick O'Malley, played by Calvin Lockhart, a Bahamian actor, by the way, arrives at a rally in Harlem. What he's doing is trying to arrange a Back to Africa movement, hiring a ship and getting people to go back to Africa and where they can live better lives than they do in Harlem. Basically, it's a scam that Dick O'Malley is running to rip people off for $87,000. Now, the $87,000 is stolen in a robbery at the rally by a group of masked people. You can't tell what race they are. And this starts a big car chase between the Reverend O'Malley, the guys who stole the $87,000, and Coffin Ed Johnson and Gravedigger Jones, the two Harlem detectives, played by Godfrey Cambridge and Raymond St. Jakes. Now, this is a really nicely done car chase, too. It's a prolonged car chase. And the interesting thing about it, apart from the fact that they have some of that beautiful kind of Mad Max style mounting the camera down near the front wheel car chase stuff through the streets of Harlem, is that there are all these little vignettes of life in Harlem that the car chase goes past, and that you just see the car chase is kind of punctuated by little moments of life and moments of humour in Harlem, which is kind of cool because it's in the title of the movie Harlem. So what Ozzie Davis does with this is show you Harlem as a real place, and even though it is slightly stylized for the movie, you do get a sense of Harlem as a place. There are a lot of shots of people driving cars through the streets and seeing kind of iconic places. That one of the climaxes in the film takes place in the Apollo Theater, for instance, and I noticed when they were kind of panning across the street towards the Apollo Theater, they had another cinema nearby. Well, that's a live theatre, but a cinema nearby was playing Putney Swope, Robert Downey Sr.'s movie Putney Swope. So that's kind of cool, and it gives us a sense of time and place in the movie. So Coffin, Ed, and Gravedigger, basically the only detectives in New York who know Harlem really well. They have their own way of doing things. they're they know the community incredibly well, whereas the white cops, played in this by John Anderson and Eugene Roach, don't know it as well. They kind of know the community. They know the Italian mafia boss in the community, played by Leonardo Cimino in this one, in a quite funny little role. They know the black head of the mafia, who works underneath Cimino's character in the area. They know all the scammers, they know all the pickpockets, they know all the people in the street, they know the junkies. There's actually a scene with a junkie, and the junkie in that scene is played by Clevon Little, who 4 years later played Black Bart in Blazing Saddles. So they got a really fine cast in this movie, and an interesting plot that drags you along. They got a nice twist at the end. You got Red Fox playing a street guy who picks up junk and sells it to a junk merchant, played by Lou Jacoby, another famous New York actor, character actor. And Red Fox, of course, you know from Sanford and Sons, but you also know from before that, if you did, the whole bunch of kind of comedy albums he did, which were considered filthy at the time. He was kind of like in the same realm as Rudy Ray Moore and people like that. So this movie is a kind of patchwork piece in a way. You've got the police procedural stuff with Coffinette and Gravedigger. You've got the relationship between Deke O'Malley and his girlfriend in the film, Iris, played by Judy Pace. You've got the cops, John Anderson and Eugene Roach, and their relationship with Godfrey Cambridge's character and Raymond St. Jakes' character. You've got a white cop, a uniform white cop called Jerima, played by Dick Sabol, who gets into an unusual situation with Iris. You've got Teddy Wilson playing Barry, who's one of Dick O'Malley's henchmen, in a sense. You've got all sorts of... It's just a beautiful mosaic which mixes up black American urban humor of 1970 with police procedural, with comedy, with drama as well. There's a shootout at a junkyard. In fact, the junkyard owned by the Lou Jacoby character in the film, whose name is Goodman, which is really well shot. The camera angles are great. The action is chaotic, as it would be in a shootout, a three-way shootout between Deke O'Malley's people, the mafia, and Coffinette and Gravedigger. And they have the really cool thing of giving Gravedigger Jones, the Godfrey Cambridge character, not a standard pistol, but he's got a flare pistol. The pistol is used so it can illuminate the area when the gunfight starts, but he also uses it as an offensive weapon in a couple of bits, which is kind of cool and a little bit different there. Now, we're trying to film it in a non-traditional way. The camera angles are a little bit unusual, but the action does flow really, really nicely. It's like the car chase scene. Both the car chase scene and this shootout in the junkyard are probably the two big action scenes in the film, and they are put together really, really nicely. But as well as all of this, you've got a number of other aspects to the film. I mean, you've got the fact that there's a bale of cotton in Harlem which may be hiding the $87,000. And because of urban black America's relationship with sharecropping cotton in the South, and the fact that Harlem is the place where people escape from that kind of life, and seeing a bale of cotton in Harlem is such a weird and unusual thing that harks back to previous black history. As the lady says in the trailer, there is no such thing as a bale of cotton in Harlem. And even though she's standing there and looking at it and looking at Red Fox, she doesn't believe it's there, because it's just something that's so of another world, and of a world that people who lived in Harlem at the time had escaped, that it was just such an unlikely thing that she refused to believe it was there. And the, of course, $87,000 was a lot of money in that time, particularly for poor people. And you've got a number of people who want it. You've got the mafia, who certain aspects of the mafia who want it. You've got Deke O'Malley who wants it. You've got the cops who want to get it back, of course. You've got everybody who hears about the bale of cotton with the money who wants it. So, you know, you've got a whole bunch of different sociological and legal forces, and illegal forces, of course, coming together, all trying to get their hands on this bale of cotton. Now, the bale of cotton ends up in the Apollo Theatre and is used as a part of a dance act done by a kind of stripper or exotic dancer called Billy, played by Mabel Robinson, who now is one of the best regarded teachers of dance in New York City at the moment. So that's kind of cool too. But she basically does a kind of Aunt Jemima striptease on top of this bale of cotton and kind of shows how, in her dance, how people shucked off that old image of black people as kind of the rural, poor, working sharecroppers and became their own people. So she uses the bale of cotton as a platform for this interpretive dance about how people are liberating themselves from that kind of agricultural poverty. So there's all sorts of aspects to this movie which are really cool and really interesting. You've got the humour of Godfrey Cambridge, which comes out nicely, and there are also some dramatic bits in there. And then you've got Raymond St. Jakes, who's taller and slightly older and has a bit more gravitas than Gravedigger Jones. And they're a really nice buddy team there. They're both on the same page, but they're not necessarily on the same line. And that works really nicely. There's a bit with a potential riot, which they diffuse in a very unusual way in the film. It's just one of those movies. This is one of the movies that's kind of the blue touch paper for blaxploitation cinema. It showed that you could do a crime action comedy film set in Harlem with black actors and that it would be a viable box office proposition. Which indeed it was. There was a sequel as well called Come Back Charleston Blue, which I haven't been able to find a copy of. So if anybody can steer me in the direction of a copy of that, I'd be really appreciative too. I want to see how the characters hold up in their second outing. I think I saw it a long time ago, but I have absolutely no memory of the movie. But I do want to check it out, not just for completeness sake, but because I want to revisit the characters again, which is the reason I'm going to be reading the novels again fairly soon. But the cinematography is really sharp in the film. I really like the cinematography. I like the way that Ossie Davis put it all together. And kind of, even though it was by United Artists, so it was a studio film in a sense, like Watermelon Man, it stays true to the culture of the man making the film. And it doesn't kind of cop out. It doesn't do stupid things in order to try to engage an audience. In fact, there's a bit of blackface in the film, which is treated very, very nastily as well. One of the white criminal characters ends up to infiltrate the Apollo Theatre, ends up doing blackface, a character played by J.D. Cannon called Calhoun. And that in itself, A, is very brave of them to do, very brave of the actor to do. You do not want to be on the stage in the Apollo Theatre with an audience of extras in blackface waving a gun. It's probably not a good survival strategy any time. But nonetheless, the movie is vastly entertaining. It's a real lot of fun. You've got to take it in the cultural context of 1970 and race relations as they were then. They've moved on now, but there are still a lot of those problems, but this was a movie that kind of celebrated black culture and black urban culture. It recognized where that culture had come from, the cotton and the South and all those kind of themes in it, which were in Chester Himes' original novels. And you've got some fine actors doing some good stuff. Watching this movie and watching Watermelon Man means that I'm now going to be on a binge, probably, unless I get distracted, of revisiting a lot of blaxploitation movies, because I kind of like the energy of them. I definitely like the music of them. And they're kind of escapist as well into my early years, because the first R-rated movie, I've said this before on the podcast, and I apologize for repeating myself. The first R-rated movie I saw in the cinema was Slaughter, the blaxploitation movie with Jim Brown, Stella Stevens, Rip Torn in it, which I have talked about on the podcast previously. I did an episode with Slaughter and Boxcar Bertha on it. But that kind of stuff was the kind of movies I was watching when I was a teenager, when I could sneak into the cinema, even though you're supposed to be 18 to see a lot of these movies. I was watching movies like Cotton Comes to Harlem and Slaughter and Shaft and all of those things. So in a weird kind of trans-Pacific sense, my cultural background as a movie viewer is that kind of exploitation movie and blaxploitation films. And probably, and this is a big stretch, and I'll admit to it being a big stretch, having those kind of movies as a seminal influence on me, it's probably made me less racist than I would have been. I grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney. They are not, it's not the most enlightened milieu in the world. It is not Shangri-La by any means. And poverty and hatred and race hatred there was very much a thing, but it's something that, to the extent that any white middle-aged man can, I've attempted and endeavoured to avoid. But I love the energy and the music. I like the direction. I hadn't seen the movie for a number of years, so there were enough plot points that I saw this time around that I'd forgotten that kind of blindsided me. There's a really nice story arc with the Iris character played by Judy Pace, who starts out, you think that she's just kind of a sexy black woman willing to use her sexuality to confuse the cops and to do what she likes. But there's an arc to her story as well. And even though she's stunningly beautiful in the movie and sexy and has some very provocative nude scenes, as the story progresses, she's arrested and we see her in jail when she's been bruised and she's not wearing makeup. She's dressed in a smock and she's kind of changed her viewpoint on the world because of that incarceration and because she's been fucked over by the Reverend Deke. And her character has an internal strength that, because maybe because of my limitations and because of me being a heterosexual male, I didn't see earlier in the movie. But later on you see that she stands up to the people who are doing wrong by her and takes action on that. And also Judy Pace as an actor was willing to get rid of the makeup, get rid of all the artifice, have a really bad hairdo, be dressed in a smock with a bruise on her face, and portray the role like that. So I like that. I admire that a lot, where, particularly in 1970, starlets, and in a sense, that's probably what she was, a starlet or a minor actor, usually want to look as good as possible so they can get the next job. But Judy Pace in this one really went the distance for the character and for the story, and that is something that I really like in this film. And it's a minor thing, but it's something that was very, very cool for me. And it's something that I hadn't noticed the first time I watched the film, and I hadn't really kind of registered. And, yeah, and in a sense, even though she does start out as kind of, yeah, a sexy blaxploitation kind of actress, not of the strong Pam Grier type, eventually she gets there. And I like that a lot. And I do like the chemistry between Ramis and Jakes and Godfrey Cambridge. I think they work really well as actors together, and that kind of works well. They also have a nice rapport with Eugene Roach playing their immediate supervisor, who's more on their side than he's not, and John Anderson playing the guy above him, who, because of his stern kind of Puritan-looking visage, always played hard roles in cinema, and did a pretty good job in this one. And the locations are really great too. The location shooting is fantastic. I only went through Harlem once when I was in New York, and I know now from what I've been told by people, it's becoming very gentrified, which is kind of a shame. I believe Brooklyn's much more like Harlem was in those days than it is now. But yeah, I mean, I like this movie for a lot of reasons. It's got an energy to it. It tells a story from a viewpoint. It's got interesting characters. It's got a plot that you can follow and that makes logical sense and that ends up in a satisfactory way, and with a comic twist at the ending as well, when Coffinet and Gravedigger receive a postcard. But yeah, Cotton Comes to Harlem, if you're a historian of blaxploitation cinema at all, this is one of your touchstones. This and the more commercial things like Shaft and, of course, Dolomite and all the other ones. The Mac, you've got to go to the Mac. There are a whole bunch of them. And it's a really creative time for cinema in America, and independent cinema and studio cinema at the time. But it was a really cool time for cinema, and it was a time which was more inclusive, perhaps, in some ways than it is now. But anyway, that's about it for this time around. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed both of these two movies, and I enjoyed talking about them, and the fact that I'm now getting enough sleep thanks to what they call CPAP technology, where I wear a mask on my face, and it stops me from snoring and waking myself up in the middle of the night. I've got a lot more energy for podcasting, and I'm really enjoying that. Now, we have a new Patreon subscriber, and because I haven't incorporated his credit into the end of the podcast, and of course, people can support the podcast via Patreon, going to patreon.com/paleocinema. And I'd just like to give his credit up front now. So, thanks to Eric Peterson, who in our little pantheon of credits wants to, let's have a look here, I've just got the thing up. His credit, he wants to be the set security lead, so Eric is now the set security lead, and he wanted me to cover some films, so he had a couple which he wanted me to cover. He wanted me to cover CQ, which I may well do in Martian Driving Podcast, I think it's more right than that. Z Channel and Magnificent Obsession, Le Magnifique, which was A Man from Acapulco from 1973, which is a Jean-Paul Belmondo film, which I have a copy of. In fact, if I stand up and reach across to the shelf now, there is my copy of Le Magnifique, Philippe de Broca film, and it is a French pressing because I picked up my copy of this very film in Paris in 2004. So Le Magnifique will be the movie I'm going to do for Eric in a future Paleo Cinema podcast. And I'll also do CQ in Martian Driving Podcast for him. So thanks for that, Eric. Really appreciate that. And that, of course, leads me to the rest of the credits, which I will now play for you. And of course, as usual, they're done in the style of film credits as well. So in the meantime, enjoy your film watching. Look after yourselves. Take care. Watch really good films. Watch really bad films. Watch films by yourself or with people you love. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema podcast. Next week with another Martian Driving podcast. I'll catch you later. Bye.
Introducing two cops only a mother could love. Meet Coffin Ed Johnson and Grave Digger Jones, two of New York's finest. Two cops who take charge when an $87,000 bale of cotton comes to Harlem.
Tell me something, will you? What's a bale of cotton doing in Harlem?
A bale of cotton?
Bale of cotton.
Now, what would a bale of cotton be doing in Harlem?
Down south, cotton was king.
Cotton comes to Harlem. It's Cops and Robbers with a shade of difference.
See any cotton around here lately?
A bale of cotton, sure.
Where is it now?
Did you turn Japanese?
Wait, come on, you know the position. Come on.
Damn it.
Another fine mess you got us into.
I got us into. Shut up and shoot.
Godfrey Cambridge is Grave Digger Jones. Raymond St. Jock is Coffin Ed Johnson. Calvin Lockhart.
Well, if it ain't King Kong and Frankenstein.
Hey, what kind of talk is that, soul brother? Don't you know that black is beautiful?
They put a personal touch on everything they handle.
You have to play with that thing.
I'm insecure, Captain.
They're big. They're cool. They're beautiful.
Where is that bale of cotton?
There ain't no such thing as a bale of cotton in Harlem.
Is that black enough for you?
I finally found that bale of cotton.
One thing's for sure. It ain't drugstore cotton.
This is genuine Mississippi cotton.
Don't you know it? Cotton from the Harlem. Come on, let's boot cotton's bud.
Get me a stick and I'm gonna kick cotton in the butt.
Coffin Ed Johnson and Gravedigger Jones, two cops only a mother could love.